You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2015 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the third class in a series given by Brother Simon Dean on the subject, Read, Mark, and Learn. This class is titled, People Keeping.
So good morning, everyone. Mark 2, verse 23. Let's read together. On a Sabbath day, he was walking through the cornfields, and as his disciples went along, they were plucking ears of corn. The Pharisees said to him, "See, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath day?" He said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were in need and were hungry? He entered the house of God when Abiathar was the high priest and ate the bread of the presence, which it is not lawful to eat except for the priests, and gave it to his companions also. He said to them, the Sabbath was made for the sake of man, not man for the sake of Sabbath. Therefore, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." I want to start off with the Pharisees' theory of creation. I don't want to appear disrespectful at all, but God and the angels are there and they're looking around. There's nothing much happening. They're wondering, what are we going to do? And someone comes up with a great idea. "I know. I think we need to create some rules." That's a great idea. And so they create some huge rules, golden, sparkling diamond rules. And those rules are floating around in space. And they're looking on thinking, not much happening here, is there? It all goes quiet. We need something else. Something is missing. What is it? Of course, we've got to have some people to obey the rules. There's no point having rules without people keeping them. And so they create people to keep the rules. And that's the Pharisees' creation story. God created rules and then he created men. God made people to keep the Sabbath. And brothers and sisters, in this talk, I want to point to how Mark shows what kingdom living looks like by holding up a mirror to the Pharisees and, as it were, keying off what the Lord Jesus Christ says about them and their attitudes. And we can learn the Jesus positives from the Pharisees' negatives. We're going to be, at least to start with, in the section called the controversy or controversy section, depending on which side of the sea you come from. And it's chapters 2 and 3. And we said yesterday that Jesus is in a battle. He is bringing around the transformation that Isaiah promised. He is the strong man. He's dealing with the unclean spirits that are in the minds and the hearts and the thinking of Israel, and particularly the Pharisees. He is the inbreaking of God's power. And as we said yesterday, this brings forth a challenge. People do not like what he says, and in particular, the leaders of the people, the Pharisees. So we're going to see in this section, and I kind of looked at the talk and said, well, you know, this is a sort of one-trick pony talk, at least in the first half of it, and concluded, yeah, but that's what Mark is saying. So there will be a number of examples which illustrate a similar point. But the profound message, I think, is it is so consistent and so regular. It's like a drumbeat. Your law, your Torah, that's the Hebrew word for law. Your Torah is not made in the image of God. Your traditions are not in the image of God. People are in the image of God. And Jesus' message is, if your tradition or your insistence on the rules results in the image of God being distorted or destroyed in those who are created in the image of God, then you cannot be my disciple. It's people that matter, and you have let your religion blind you to that, and you are using God's law, the Torah, to destroy people made in the image of God. Just let's think about the Pharisees. We like to make them the bogeymen, the bad guys, all black, no white at all. We are liable to make those simplistic assertions. The Pharisees want to make sure that holiness is observed. Holiness for them, it means following the rules, Sabbath observance, washing your hands. The Pharisees are not legalists. They are seeking to respond in a way that they think is appropriate to the grace that has been shown them. They were taken out of Egypt. They were led to the promised land. And now how do you react in a way which is God-honoring to that? It's important for us to realize as we go through this that we are a lot more like them than we care to admit. We say, yes, we are saved by grace. And then we have all sorts of other things which we put in place. And say, in effect, if you want to respond appropriately to God's love, this is what you have to do. And the Pharisees didn't get together and say, let's make some rules that make people unhappy. They're doing it out of a deep kind of love, a kind of love for God. And we can do that too. And what are the consequences of taking that position? It means that they start drawing circles and they start defining, doesn't come out, but the final tile there is a slightly different color. They start setting up fences and determining who is in and who is out. And that, and in a sense, they're saying, this is who we deem to be acceptable. People who look like them, who are the same color tile as them. You are acceptable to God, you are not acceptable to God. You are in and you are out. And Jesus says, countless times through Mark's gospel, as we shall see, your laws are blinding you. You are deaf and blind, like those in Babylon are deaf and blind, to the image of God in all people. So let's look at that section that we read, the first of a few examples in this controversy section where this drumbeat message comes out. Home in on it like a laser. Listen to the words that Jesus is saying. Look at what David did. You criticize my Pharisees, but look at the principle that David set out and hone in on the words that Jesus uses here in verse 25. Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were in need and were hungry? He entered the house of God when Abiathar was high priest. And he did which is not lawful to eat except for the priest. Can you see how right now at the beginning Jesus is setting up in opposition? You've got the rules over here and then you've got two words, really important, the word need and the word hunger. And now that's the dilemma. Which one is king? Which one is the overriding principle? David is using David. David is the example who no one is going to criticize. And David looked like a lawbreaker. But what he was doing, he was demonstrating what the law was designed to affirm. The disciple must be involved in people keeping and not Sabbath keeping. It's need and hunger. And the new kingdom policies override the old governance. The Lord of the Sabbath, Jesus, is here, and he's showing God's care for man. And we mustn't misunderstand the creation story like the Pharisees do. The making of Sabbath was for man, not the other way around. Because this is what it leads up to. The Sabbath was made for the sake of man, not man for the sake of the Sabbath. Your creation story is broken. It's upside down and front to back. Sabbath came about because of people, not people because of the Sabbath. And Israel, and the Pharisees in particular, are giving a status to the law that God only gives to human beings. And we don't do that, do we, brothers and sisters? We're going to see in these examples in Mark's gospel, we're going to hear the message of Jesus and say, okay, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for me in my ecclesia? What must I learn from these examples? If you go just slightly before that to verse 21 of chapter 2, they've got this picture of how things are going to tear apart unless we start to observe the truths of what Jesus is saying. The patch which tears the cloth, the wine which bursts the wineskins. We saw in talk one how there's this great tearing sound in Mark's gospel. The tearing of the heavens at the beginning. The tearing of the veil of the temple at the end. And there are other tears now. The tear is saying you need to break, you need to make sure that the break is clean. We can't limp along with a bit of the old and a bit of the new. And when the high priest, when Jesus says, yes, I am the Messiah, I am the Son of the Blessed, the high priest, as you will recall, tears his garments, in a sense saying, well, the garments represent the man, his role. His role is now broken, it's torn, it's come to an end, it's going to be superseded. Kingdom thinking involves no compromise. The old ways of ritual and rule are incompatible with the king. And it's going to be destructive to revert to the old lifestyle. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the wineskins. No one puts a new patch and takes away some of the old cloth. And the tear, that's the word schisma, which we saw in the opening of the heavens tearing. There'll be a tearing that takes place, suggesting that it will be destructive to revert to the old lifestyle and practices. It's a new world. The rules of the Sabbath cannot apply and do not apply, as the Lord of the Sabbath is here, and he's rewriting those rules in and around himself. The call of Levi. I want to see this consistent message, as Jesus encounters the Pharisees. First of all, the calling. Where does it take place? It's not a very, very richly coloured photo because of the projector, but that's by the Sea of Galilee. Look, it's there in chapter 2 and verse 13. He went out again by the sea. Listen to Mark. Read Mark and learn. What happens by the sea? The calling of disciples takes place by the sea. And the fishermen, they are not the holy ones. They're not the ones that you'd expected. Why aren't you calling Pharisees? Why not call them? That's bad enough to call a fisherman, but now there's a tax collector being called by the sea. And the question is, do the disciples know him? Do they come back? And is he sitting there ready and waiting to take the custom? And do you think maybe that the disciples have given tax unwillingly to Levi? And in this moment, God shows that God's grace is open to all. And now the disciples must walk beside Levi. And we can imagine the Lord Jesus Christ walking down the street and on maybe one side of them, disciples looking rather disgruntled. Because Levi is there, the one who has fleeced them of taxes. And now he is now part of the group. And what happens when God calls people who are not like us, that do not fit our model? We don't get to choose our relatives, nor do you get to choose those who walk by you and with you on the road to the kingdom. What do we deal when there are people who we consider outsiders because they don't speak or act like us? God's grace is there for us, and we don't get the right to choose who God gives his grace to. So if God can show grace to me, then why can't he show it to others? Now look very carefully here at how Mark presents this moment when the man who is at the very, very edge of what is acceptable, beyond the pale as it were, a tax collector, hated, despised. Look at the way now Mark presents what is going on in Jesus' call. It's very, very powerful and interesting. See how carefully and artfully he makes the simple but profound point that a sinner has become a disciple. And there is in the text a blending of disciple and sinners and tax collectors, which is embedded in, people talk about a double chiasm. But I'm gonna read these verses, and I don't want you to look at the text. I want you to look at the screen to see how Mark has carefully introduced this moment when sinner, tax collector, and disciple come together. So I'm reading from verse 15, but you, if you would, look at the screen. Once he was at a meal in a house, and many tax collectors and sinners were at the meal with Jesus and his disciples, for they were many. There also followed him the scribes of the Pharisees. And seeing him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" Jesus, hearing this, said to them, "It is not the strong who need a doctor, but the sick." You see how there is a framing of the disciples with tax collectors and sinners. The blending shows in the text what is happening in reality. God in action is realigning people's expectation of what the kingdom of God is like, who is in. These are the people who Jesus is happy to be with. Notice how on a couple of times he says there are a lot of them. Once he was at a meal in his house, and many tax collectors and sinners were at the meal with Jesus and his disciples. For they were many. It's almost as if Mark is overloading the point. There are a lot of them there. And of course, this is not something that people would feel comfortable with. And it's asking the question, it's this big question that now Jesus is effectively challenging the Pharisees with. Who is in God's people? It's not the Pharisees model, the holy fence model, where purity results in separation. And here in this episode of the call of Levi, the word disciple is used for the first time. And it's a significant moment to introduce the idea of the disciple as sinner and disciple are woven together. And they are made to look quite similar. Because the point is it's only sinners who can become disciples. Because if you think you're healthy, then you have no part. And that's what the Pharisees do. They want to insist on their program of separation. They object, verse 16. Seeing him eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" So the rules are more important. The rules are more important than what? Well, it's that word again. Did you see it? We saw it in the matter of the eating of the ears of corn. It's that word need. It is not the strong who need a doctor, but the sick. It's a matter of need. And we ask ourselves, do we overly concern ourselves with status and who we associate with? We're so careful at times about the rules. We fail to see the need. We think the Sabbath rules are more important than keeping people. And we see how rules, they're not neutral. They end up, in effect, reinforcing the situation that the Pharisees have created, that, well, we don't want to mix with the unrighteous. And the point that Jesus is making is that you take that view and it begins to get in the way of Jesus' kingdom work. Because he's right there in the middle of them, the tax collector, the sinner, the disciple. You are missing the need of people, the need for the salvation of Jesus. I heard a story once about a Bible camp, actually, and someone was recounting how he was there at this church camp over the summer, and it was a public camp, and they'd all gone out for the day, and he was drinking a beer, It was more liberal than Manuka. He was drinking a beer, and he hears a challenge, and someone's walking along the road, and it's actually a man who is an atheist, who is married to one of the women in the church, and he shouts out, "Hey, Christians don't drink!" And he sort of becomes accosted by this man, and he'd come to the camp under sufferance, and he invites the man over. He said, "Would you like a beer?" And so he sits down, and they start drinking together. He says, "What are you reading?" "Oh, I'm reading Nietzsche." And the man says, "Well, I didn't think Christians read such stuff, and they certainly didn't believe that they should be drinking in a church camp." And they talk, and the man explains how Jesus fits in. And he's got some wine. He said, "Would you like a glass of wine too?" And he says, offers him some wine. And there's another person walking along. It's an elder within the church. He's looking across, and he says, do you want to come over? Do you want to come and sit down?" And the elder looks, and he's very uncertain, very unsure, really, really not sure about the whole situation and what's going on. Anyway, he does come over. And so they carry on, the three of them carry on talking now, the elder sitting kind of just watching and listening what's going on. And 20 or 30 minutes later, the atheist said, "Okay, I'm convinced, you know, so where do I sign up?" I'm sure it wasn't like that. But in other words, through the process of the discussion, the man has come to see things quite differently. I want to follow. And next morning, there's a knock at the door, and the man gets up, and there is the elder. He's like, "Oh no, oh dear, okay." And he's got a look on his face. He's anxious. "Is there something on your mind?" He thinks he knows what's covering. "Is there something that's bothering you?" And the elder starts to cry. And he says, "All my life I have wanted to relate to people like Jesus. Yesterday was the first time I saw it. Will you teach me how to do that?" And here it is in Mark. We're so easily confused about what sickness is and what wholeness is all about, that you can't do this and you can't do that. And all those little rules. Jesus says, you've got to look past it. He says, forget it. It's people that matter. Those who are not in need of a physician are not those who I need to reach out and touch, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. And so we look at these passages in Mark and we say, is that how our ecclesias are viewed? Is that how I'm viewed? Is it the place where the healthy hang out rather than the unhealthy and the sick? Are we primarily about being a place for good, healthy people that look like us? It's really easy to get a long way away from Jesus, a long way away from him. And then apparently when he told this story, at the end of it, a number of people got up and said, you know, "We were really unhappy with that story. There's talk too much about wine, too much about beer, too much about alcohol." And you think, it's about people. It's not about Sabbath keeping. It's about people keeping. And this is time and time again what happens in this section. Let's look at the man with the withered hand. Look to see how this theme is there in every single one of these confrontations. He entered the synagogue again, and a man with a withered hand was there. They watched him to see if he was healing him on the Sabbath in order to accuse him. He said to the man with the withered hand, "Stand in the middle." He said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, or to save a life or to kill?" But they were silent, looking round on them with anger, being grieved at the insensibility of their minds. He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees immediately went out with the Herodians and conferred together against him to see how they might destroy him. It's the Sabbath again. It's a time when the rules are observed. And the Pharisees are saying, if it breaks my Sabbath rule, it cannot be from God. And you see how a dangerous position that lands you up in. Who would say you have to wait till Monday morning to be healed? The Lord of the Sabbath brings life on the Sabbath. He's pushing the boundaries of the kingdom forward. And they, on the other hand, as we see in verse 6, confer together how they might destroy him on the Sabbath day. And they don't see the irony of that. So he reaches out to the man in need, ignoring their desire for Sabbath purity, and he is healed. And note how Jesus is angry. He doesn't say, I understand the sincerity of your hearts. He is angry. This is powerful stuff. And he is grieved. He is grieved at what he is seeing. And brothers and sisters, do we look on ourselves and analyze ourselves and grieve when we see that our kind of prior theological commitments, the issues where we expect others to cross their T's and dot their I's, exactly the same as we do, drive us to inflexible positions? The Pharisees had made an idol of their religion. It was rule-bound and it was inflexible, and they had become like it. I think this is a powerful set of confrontations because it speaks so much to what is weak and flawed within ourselves, where we put the emphasis is, where we put the emphasis, and how it may be that our prior convictions about what should and shouldn't be done means that we end up not being open to the grace of God. The theme is people keeping and not Sabbath keeping, reaching out to the least and the lost. Another illustration. There's a film, it's called The Full Monty. I don't imagine that it's made much of an impact over here because it's an English film and it's a bittersweet film, and it's in such a broad dialect that you guys would probably need subtitles to understand it. And it's like Detroit, Sheffield after the steel industry falls apart. It's like, I guess, like Detroit, and these men are out of work. And it's a profound movie about what it means to be a man where you can't provide for your family. And they see a bunch of strippers and they think, oh, they're making such easy money. We could do that. And they're sort of thin and big and gangly and they can't dance. And they say, no one's going to come and watch us. We've got to go the whole hog. And that's what the phrase means in English, in the UK, it means, you know, to sort of stripping down to absolutely when you're naked, and so they're trying to make money, and it's a really, really powerful, as I say, bittersweet sort of film, and they say we can do that, and so they start practicing, and they're funny individuals, and there's one who's overweight, and he's got no coordination and no rhythm, and he finally says, okay, I can't do this, and he pulls out. And he comes home, and he calls up for his wife, and it's silent, absolutely silent. So he goes up to his room, and she's sitting there in silence. And she has found, I don't know what it is, a posing pouch. It doesn't bear thinking about. Anyway, she's found it. And she is absolutely furious. And there is lots of strong language, a lot of swearing. It's a really powerful moment where she feels she's been betrayed. And she's completely got the wrong point. He tries to reach out for her. He says, no. And she says, I thought you were out looking for work, and this is what you've been doing. And it's, as I say, it's not pretty. There's a lot of swearing. And he says, well, we wanted to do this strip thing, and we were going to try and make some money. And it moves from anger. It's a great piece of movie making. Anger to disbelief. You? Well, I wasn't that bad. You? It's a wonderful piece of that transition from fury to disbelief. And then it changes again. He says, well, I'm not going to do it now. And there's a really tender moment, really tender moment. Why not? Why are you not going to do it now? It's brilliant, brilliant, explosive, earthy language is now moving from disbelief to tenderness. Why not? And he says, well, who would want to see this dance? And she says to him, I would, Dave. I would. And people get up every morning and they look at themselves in the mirror and they say, who would want to see this dance? And God wants to say through you and through me to every one of those people, I would. I would. That's what the love of God is about. And I heard someone use that clip. And again, the person who used that clip was asked to issue an official apology because of all the swearing. And it illustrates the issues with the Pharisees. They just don't get it. It's not about rules. It's not about language. It's not about wine. It's not about beer. It's about people keeping. And that's what the issue is about. Of course, it's not about bad language and drinking. Yeah, absolutely. It's not about those things. And those are not good things. But it needs to look beyond that. It's not about our ecclesial traditions, about our personal perspectives and what is acceptable, dress, music, whatever the right translation is. Because if we see just that, then we're in danger of being so blind, so deaf, that we end up saying, come back on Monday morning to be healed. Only people are made in God's image. We put them first. That's what God wants us to keep through Jesus. Not how you are received, it's how you receive others. And as we will see tomorrow in tomorrow's talk, God willing, how do we do that? Well, we will do that by dying, by taking the cross and following him. It's not about Sabbath keeping. It's how we treat people. And we're so busy sometimes defending our theology. We think we are being holy, but we are not. And we almost end up using God as a weapon. And it continues. It continues. As I say, I'm making the same point here. You're not going to hear anything different in this part of the talk, but that's because that's what Mark is presenting to us in this section. So let's go to Mark chapter 7 and see again another variation. And the fact that it's repeated and the fact that it's so insistent, I think, is this is an important issue you need to hear and realize, because it's a real danger. And we need to, as it were, learn the lesson of the Pharisees. So again, have a look at it. It's a summary section at the end of chapter 6, which sets out what Jesus has been doing. Verse 53, having crossed over to the land, they arrived at Gennesaret and put in there. As soon as they left the boat, men recognized him. They ran all through that district, and they carried the sick to him on pallets wherever they heard he was. Wherever he went into villages, cities, and farms, they put the sick in the marketplaces and entreated him that he might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched him were made well. So that's the background. And notice how then the next section is about the washing of hands, the tradition. And notice the link between the two sections, because I think it's important that we see that background in chapter 6 as the lead into chapter 7. The Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem joined him, and dropping down to verse 4, talks about the washing of hands and how they did not eat anything from the marketplace unless they washed themselves. And Jesus has been doing what in the marketplace? What has he been doing there? He has been healing people. He has been, as it were, pushing back the realm of Satan, the realm of sin. He's been releasing people. And now the question comes, who are the people of Israel? Are the common people of Israel, the one who do things in the marketplaces and don't wash their hands, are they part of God's people? And the Pharisees are beginning to, as you can see, exclude people. You know, if you don't wash your hands, then you're not part of who we define as to who is in or who is out. And are the Pharisees rejoicing over those who've received their sight? They're saying, well, that's all very nice, but you have been made to walk. Yes, but your fingernails are dirty. And the man comes out and said, I've just had my leprosy cleansed. And the Pharisees say, I don't care. Have you washed your hands yet? And you see how our deeply held commitments can lead us to positions like that if we don't put people first. If we put Sabbath keeping before people keeping. This terrible legalism can be demonstrated by very well-meaning people if they do not understand what God means. And we end up a long way from God, verse 6. He answered them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy about you hypocrites and say, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Vainly they worship me, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men.'" Can you see how, again, this is the same point. Jesus is confronting their inability to look past what they have created in terms of the rules as to who should do this and who should do that, who is in and who is out, and it leads to exclusions. It leads to a distortion of God's teaching. The Pharisees have become blind to the image of God in people. And they're using the Torah, they're using the law to abuse people. You're using the law to escape your obligations to other people. Do we do that, brothers and sisters? Do we do that such that we don't take God's law seriously? We're more concerned about ritual than being faithful to God, what God wants. Look at verse 9. He said to them, "How well you set aside God's commandment in order to establish your own tradition." You're hypocrites. You are hypocrites. It's tradition and not people that matter. And look what it ends up you doing. You mistreat those who should be receiving God's grace. Verse 13. "You annul the pronouncement of God by your tradition, which you have handed down, and you do many similar things." And it means that they teach this doctrine that results in the elderly man, the father or the mother, not being looked after and not being cared for. Can you see that link between the insistence on the tradition and the impact that it has on those who are in need? And why does he use this example of the parent, do you think? The mistreating of the parent. Well, if we go to Paul in Ephesians chapter 6, we can see that it is a marker of those who really are the people of God. "Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land." The implication is that they're not doing it. They will not live long in the land. The fig tree is cursed. "You're dwelling in the land," and this is a message to us, brothers and sisters, "your dwelling in the land is contingent on how you deal with those who are in need, your parents, the poor, and us. How do we measure up? How do we, when we look at ourselves, how much do we concern ourselves and with what we believe are the right things to be done and fail to see the image of God in people? It's not tradition, it's not rules, it's the image of God in people. And the interesting thing is, if we go right to the end, we have the widow and her mite. And the powerful point here, as I think, is that we've come to the end, the end of Jesus' public ministry. And you imagine it's going to go. And so after this, okay, so we have Mark 13, which is the teaching to the disciples about the temple. And thereafter, it's going to be the Last Supper, trial, and crucifixion. So this is the end. This is the end of the ministry. This is the end of what Jesus is all about. And he ends up with the little people, with the least, with the woman and her mite. And again, it's the same point. It's the distortion of what is true and the failure to see the image of God. Chapter 12, we see how the lead into the widow's mite is those who mistreat those who are weak. So chapter 12. And go at verse 38. "In his teaching, he said to them, 'Beware of the scribes who like walking about in robes, salutations in the marketplaces, the chief seats in synagogues, and the best places at feasts. They who devour widows' houses and for show offer long prayers will receive greater condemnation.'" This is the end of his public teaching, and it's now coming down and narrowing down onto this poor widow and her mite, who is at the receiving end of the Pharisees and their tradition and their rule-keeping and their fence-creating and their circle-establishing. Who is in and who is out? And what is the determinant? It's whether you keep our rules and whether you wash your hands and whether you observe the Sabbath. And he sat opposite the treasury and saw how the crowd put money into the treasury. Many rich men put in much, and a poor widow came and put in 2 lepta, that is a quadrans. He called his disciples and he said to them, in truth I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than any who put into the treasury. For they all put in out of their abundance, but this woman out of her destitution has put in all she had, all her livelihood. The Pharisees and the scribes, they are in danger of destroying the widows, the widows' houses. And they are in danger of destroying the one made in God's image. So it's the people and how we keep people that it all comes down to. The shepherds should be there for the sake of the sheep, for the sake of those who are in the image of God. And when she put some money in the divine exchange rate, it looks differently. It didn't make any difference in the books of the temple, but it's immortalized in the book of life. And how powerfully that word is more. She put in more than all that everyone else had put in. It's her genuine piety, her faith, which is contrasted to pretense of those who are wealthy. So we ask ourselves, are we really converted? Are we really following Jesus? Have we heard the message of his confrontation, his controversy with those Pharisees? Are we using Jesus to bless our comfortable, affluent lifestyle? Because we've seen the pattern time and time again. Israel has been called to change the world, to be the agents of God's change, to be the light on a hill. And all they've done is to become looking like the world that they are part of. You love stuff, Jesus says. You love stuff. You love tradition. You love rules. You love money. You love land more than you love people. And the response to that is the way of the Lord. You must renounce power. You must adopt the call to Jesus to follow. That denial of self, the way of discipleship. And the way of discipleship is the way of the cross. And it seems to me just how serious the situation is in Mark's gospel, that we move now from the widow straight into Mark 13. She has put the money into the treasury, into the temple and the temple system that has resulted in her being persecuted and other widows like her. And now Jesus says, okay, I am now going to announce the end of this corrupt system. There will not be one stone left upon another. Immediately he says that after we see the experience of the widow. So people keeping has been our theme, because I believe that's been a very, very strong theme which the Lord Jesus Christ has brought out through his interaction with the Pharisees. It's Mark's gospel theme. And why and how should we do that? How should we keep people? And the answer that Jesus gives us, how do we respond to that challenge, is because he keeps us. We serve others because the one whom we follow does all these things. He is the one who goes before us. He is the one who is amazing and fear-inducing. He is the one who stills the storm and walks on the sea. But at the end of all that, he is the one who keeps us. He serves us. And I just want to finish now with this profound moment, which is in Mark chapter 10 and verse 40. We're going at verse 42. There's a big argument about who should be the greatest. And Jesus says, okay, you need to learn a lesson. You need to learn the lesson of how I serve you, how in a sense you are to keep people, because that's what I do for you. So 10 and 42, you know that those who consider themselves to be the rulers of the nations lorded over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It's not so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So this is the call to deny ourselves and to serve. But note very carefully what Jesus says, because this is gospel. This is how we respond to that call to keep people, to serve people. It's because he serves us. Read that very, very carefully. Yes, he says you must follow me because I set you as an example. He's saying that, but he's not saying only that. He's not saying I serve, you serve. I drink the cup of suffering, you drink the cup. That's what it is to follow me. Yes, he is saying that, but it's not just that. He says, for the Son of Man came not to be served. Don't miss that. He came not to be served. He's saying to you, I've called you, brothers and sisters at Manuka. I've called you to be servants, laying down your life daily for other people, to be involved in people keeping to the point where it hurts, and ultimately in serving me it might kill you. But in that, you dare not serve me. You see? Is that in the text? In all your serving each other, you may not serve me. What does he mean by that? What is this? See, this is the gospel. This is the incredible gift of the gospel. When we've seen how we are to keep people, how to serve people. You see, the whole world thinks, I want to work for God. I want to get him on my side. The whole world thinks in that way. And Jesus called to discipleship, which is so incredibly difficult. If you think of it in terms of earning your way into my favor, you are a goner. You've got to have your whole mindset shifted around here. I am coming to serve you. That is the gospel. The gospel is not a help wanted sign from Jesus. It's a help available sign. Do you think you can drink my cup without my help? Do you think you can keep people day in, day out? Do you think you can seek to be not the first, but the last? Where's that going to come from? Do you know what it costs to be my disciple? To serve all, not just the pleasant ones, the unlovely, the one who throw it back in your face, who take and take and take? Can you keep on doing that? Apart from me, you can do nothing. He who will not let me, with all my glory, with all my riches, with all my grace, he who will not let me serve him to supply his needs, to satisfy his longings, to rescue him from all his troubles, he's not going to be able to do anything. He's not going to be able to do nothing. He's not going to be able to do anything in service. This is the gospel. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. Unless you let me be the servant in my relationship with me, with you, unless you let me be the servant in my relationship with you, you can do nothing. It's not like, brothers and sisters, we can write a check to God. Your service to your ecclesia, to your neighbor, our service to each other, our people keeping. It's not going to earn anything from God. God is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. He gives everything. Yes, we are called to be servants. We are called to be servants, but we need to get it right. Unless the Son of Man is serving you day and night, you're not going to make it. Jesus did not come into the world to get servants to get his job done. He came to be our servant, to meet our needs, so that we, serving one another, keeping people, might do it in his strength and not in our own.